on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
It's okay, you can... Today is Friday, 23rd. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Nina Kurgia. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia. To our campus, the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5 o'clock and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. All
of this, plus your weekday and weekend weather forecast, right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your UBC campus news and local headlines.
The University of British Columbia has launched two new major entrance scholarships for up to 3 years, totaling $20,000, which will be awarded annually to Aboriginal students. The scholarships are awarded based on academic excellence, leadership qualities, and community contribution. Link Kessler, director of UBC's First Nations House of Learning, said, quote, "These new awards will help more First Nations, Métis, and Inuit students benefit from opportunities at UBC, where researchers, students, and staff are engaged with issues of major importance to Aboriginal communities," end quote. The new scholarships require a B-plus average in order for the recipient to renew it each year. As part of UBC's Aboriginal Strategic Plan, launched in 2009, they are aimed at making it possible for more Aboriginal students to complete a post-secondary education. As of this year, there are more than 680 Aboriginal students enrolled at UBC. 117 were accepted this past year.
It has been announced that Gage South has been slated to be zoned in an academic area. This means that housing in this area will be exclusively for students and postdoctoral fellows. AMS President Matt Parsons said in an interview with the UBC, quote, "It really speaks to how reactive and responsive the university is to the input that they received from the community and students, how committed they are to having the heart of campus be a lively place," end quote. He also said this victory was representative of the importance of student involvement, citing the high attendance at open houses, consultation feedback, and petitions. UBC's campus and community planning representatives are presenting the recommendation to the university. This recommendation will be formalized by the Board of Governors on April 2nd. The proposed layout will be a new diesel bus loop, McInnes Field, a new aquatic center, and Gage South, which are also heading to the Board of Governors for approval.
Public backlash has erupted from a proposal by Metro Vancouver mayors to introduce a vehicle levy to help pay for transit projects, with some civic officials finding death threats in their inboxes. Langley Mayor Peter Fassbender said he received, quote, "passionate," end quote, threats after the mayor's council suggested the registration fee on all vehicles in the Metro Vancouver area in order to raise $30 million annually and avoid raising property taxes. Some of the emails simply call them names, while others stated, quote, "We're going to take you out, and we mean that literally," end quote. Peter Fassbender said, in response to this, quote, "There are some people who are extremely passionate to a fault, where it becomes personal. It's unfortunate that some people come to these extremes," end quote. BC Transportation Minister Blair Leckstrom said this week he too received emails about the proposed fee and says it is likely that, due to the public response, the levy is a non-option. However, the province has already rejected tolling roads, bridges, and tunnels, leaving the mayor's few alternatives. The mayors are looking into other ways to generate funding for immediate transit projects, like the Evergreen Line, as well as long-term transportation around the region.
In related news, Vancouver's city staff is recommending council supports in an application by Vancouver's four taxi companies to add more taxis during peak demand days. If the Passengers Transportation Board agrees to boost the number of taxis, 99 more vehicles will be on the roads on days such as Halloween, New Year's, and high-volume cruise ship days. Councillor Jeff Meigs expects that council will approve the recommendation. The additional taxis would replace the 65 which have been licensed on a trial basis and would add to the fleet of 588 taxis that operate full-time. Findings by UBC's Sauder School of Business during the pilot run of this operation revealed, quote, "a substantial improvement in taxi services," end quote. Although Vancouver Police suggest the service is inconsistent and has several problems associated with it, including service refusal and complaints about the drivers.
The City of Vancouver will announce a new Stanley Cup playoff strategy on Tuesday, which is hoped will help avoid a repeat of last year's riot. The plan is expected to include rigorous enforcement of alcohol laws and the replacement of large gathering venues with smaller, community-based celebrations. The strategy is based on many of the 53 recommendations of John Furlong and Douglas Keefe, who released an independent review back in September. They found that TransLink, the BC Liquor Control and Licensing Branch, the VPD, and others should have been more proactive in staunching the flow of liquor. Charles Gauthier, the executive director of the Downtown Business Improvement Area, said, quote, he was consulted with businesses that were heavily impacted by the riot. I said we're on the right page here in terms of not doing what we did last year, and they said absolutely, end quote. However, he noted that although the DBVIA, which is the Downtown Business Improvement Area, is wary of the consequences of last year's poor planning, it does not want to stop downtown celebrations altogether. So far, 197 charges have been laid against 75 people who participated in the riots last year.
The whooping cough outbreak in the Fraser Valley appears to be spreading to the Metro Vancouver area. 38 cases have been confirmed across the area since January. That's three times the usual number of cases for this period, said Vancouver Coastal Health. Free vaccines are available to pregnant women, their partners, and for anyone with children under 18 months as a result of the outbreak. Dr. Patricia Daly, the chief medical officer for Vancouver Coastal Health, said, quote, "Since the outbreak of the Fraser Valley began in December, we've been closely monitoring the incidence of whooping cough in our region. Because the number of cases has risen over the last week in the Vancouver Coastal Health region, we are stepping up measures to protect residents," end quote. The free vaccine is available through family doctors, public health clinics, and some pharmacies. For more details, health officials ask you to please call HealthLink at 811.
And those are your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for your provincial news as well as your weekend weather forecast.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Flaming Angels Boutique, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl, and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
This month in Discorder. This month's cover features the experimental punk band Shearing Pinks, three dudes who have been an underground Vancouver staple since 2005 and have over 50 releases, big and small, under their belts. Also featured this month are the Bleeding Hearts, who released their debut EP this month, a review on Wim Wenders' latest film, the 3D dance epic Pina, an update on the Rio's ongoing battle to show movies and serve liquor, not to mention a bunch of excellent show and album reviews, and all of your regular features. Pick up your beautiful and free copy of Discorder at any Friends of CITR business, or if you've gone paperless, don't forget to check out Discorder at discorder.ca. Discorder, that magazine from CITR, supporting local music for over 25 years. Talk about swanky. It's the Poliera Spring Masquerade and Strut Off, March 24th at the Rickshaw Theater. Five vintage clothing stores will compete in a friendly fashion show, each representing a different era and theme. Showcase your vintage best, too, with live music from Mocha Only and local faves, Prisoners, with prizes and good times for all. Proceeds go to two downtown Eastside nonprofits, Hastings Crossing BIA, and our social fabric. How cool is that? Advance tickets are available at Eventbrite Online or Zulu, Neptune, and Red Cat Records. It's the Poliera Spring Masquerade and Strut Off, March 24th at the Rickshaw Theater.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia.
And now for your provincial and national news. Susan Lambert has been re-elected president of the BC Teachers Federation, or BCTF, for a third term, defeating a more moderate candidate, Rick Gunther, by a vote of 429 to 238 during the union's annual general meeting 2 days ago. Her re-election for a third one-year term was not unexpected, given that the union is in the midst of a bitter struggle with the Liberal government over a new law that ordered a six-month cooling-off period in their protracted contract dispute and introduced controversial changes to class size and composition. But when it comes to the elections themselves, some teachers have called for changes in election procedures so that all BCTF members may have an opportunity to vote for table officers rather than just the 700 delegates who spend a portion of their spring break attending the annual meeting. So President Lambert had appealed for unity when she spoke to the delegates at the start of the three-day meeting on Sunday, before they huddled behind closed doors to plot a strategy to challenge Bill 22. They are expected to announce a protest plan after the annual general meeting and take a recommendation to the union's 41,000 members for approval.
On a similar note, the BC Teachers Federation revealed some elements of its new action plan to fight Bill 22 today, including the possibility of a full-scale walkout in the coming months. The plan starts this Monday with teachers heading back to their teaching duties after spring break, but also informing the public about their issues with Bill 22, the Education Improvement Act, which they plan to take government to court over. On April 17th and 18th, BCTF members across the province will vote on the phase two of the plan, which includes the possibility of withdrawing from extracurricular activities and even a full-scale teacher walkout. Some union locals have already declared their intention to withdraw from extracurricular activities beginning next week, which Lambert says is their right as autonomous locals. Bill 22 makes walkouts illegal, fining the union at least $1.3 million per day, union leaders or representatives at least $2,500 per day, and individual teachers $475 per day of illegal striking. Lambert told reporters she didn't know where the union would find the money to cover those costs.
And now we go to the Toronto Sun for a report on the Montreal protests that have been taking place for the past 2 days. This is a massive student protest where students in Montreal are protesting the potential student hikes, tuition hikes brought on by Premier of Quebec.
We find kind of interesting as students here because they have lower tuition rates than us, so we're thinking, should we start striking? Here is the Toronto Sun.
Students are taking to the streets of Montreal and are creating havoc on the roads right now. The march and protest are expected to attract around 100,000 people in the city and thousands more across the province. They're upset over a Quebec government plan to nearly double tuition fees over the next 5 years. Brian Daly joins us now with the latest from downtown Montreal.
Several hundred students here at Place du Canada, and they say that as many as 100,000 will be here by the end of the afternoon to protest the Liberal government's decision to hike tuitions by $325 a year over the next 5 years. Although that would still leave Quebec with some of the lowest tuitions in Canada, student leaders say that any tuition hike will eventually affect especially lower income earners here in Quebec, who they say will be frozen out of the system. The government and universities have said that universities are simply underfunded and that tuition hikes still will leave students able to access the system. Now, the other specter sort of underlying the protests here today is the activity of the Black Bloc. The anarchist group has been seen in town. Members blocked the Port of Montreal entrance this morning, causing major traffic tie-ups in the East End before dispersing. It's not clear whether members of the Black Bloc are here. Things seem peaceful at this point, and student leaders have told protesters unequivocally for the first time to remain unmasked and to keep things peaceful. However, we did notice a change in tactics by the Black Bloc. They tend now to have knapsacks and hide masks and dark clothing in those knapsacks to bring them out at the last minute. So at this point, not a heavy police presence, although the police tactics have also changed. They're ready to make preventative arrests. Also, City Hall dredging up an old idea of having a mask ban, something that they abandoned 2 years ago after concerns by civil liberties groups. But after violent protests last week in which police cruisers were overturned and there was ransacking downtown, City Hall now looking at pulling out all the stops and talking again about a ban on masks. For Sun News, I'm Brian Daly.
Thank you to the Toronto Sun for that video. And now, since Phil is not here, we are going to have to go solo on the weather update. So here is your weekend weather forecast. So tomorrow is going to be partly cloudy, but partly sunny as well. High of 12, UV index of 3 or moderate. Saturday night should become clear, becoming partly cloudy in the evening with a low of plus 5. Sunday is also a mix of sun and cloud with a high of 11. That is your weekend weather forecast. And we're going to take a quick break, but stay with us for international news.
A minute. Introducing Serious Issues. Tuesday, March 20th at the Waldorf Hotel in the Tiki Bar. From 8 p.m. to late, Serious Issues is a party for young people interested in serious issues and partying. Featuring drinking, dancing, and short multimedia talks on creative actions by people from Adbusters, LeadNow.ca, DeSmogBlog, and Steph Harper did. Cover is cheap. Tickets are available at the door or through Eventbrite.ca. RSVP on Facebook to Serious Issues. And with DJs Cam Dales and Cameron Reed, the party is sure to be seriously good. That's all. We can get back to the serious dinner stuff. Thanks. Thank you.
Can you imagine an oil spill on our coast? Enbridge and Kinder Morgan are proposing pipelines that would bring oil supertankers to the coast of the Great Bear Rainforest and expand tanker traffic through Vancouver's harbor. On March 26th, stand up for an oil-free coast at a noon hour rally featuring First Nations leaders Bill McKibben and more. March 26th, 12 noon at the Vancouver Art Gallery.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. And now for your international headlines.
A man suspected of killing seven people, including four outside a Jewish school in France, has been shot dead after a raid by armed police on an apartment in the city of Toulouse. Heavy gunfire lasting several minutes could be heard on Thursday as police entered the apartment of the suspect, identified as Mohamed Marat. Marat's death has ended a siege that lasted 32 hours. Claude Guyon, France's interior minister, said the suspect had emerged from the bathroom of the apartment and started firing at police as they used a video camera to check each room of the upper floor apartment. He then jumped out of the window. Francois Moulin, a French prosecutor, said Marat was killed after being shot in the head by a sniper. Moulin said, quote, "Weapons and ammunition were recovered from the scene of the siege and also materials for making Molotov cocktails. Everything was done to keep him alive, but he resisted and fired at police as he tried to escape through the window," end quote. Police said they wanted to capture him alive so that he could stand in trial. Many are wondering why Marat wasn't apprehended earlier, since his name was already being brought up by police after the first two shootings in Toulouse in which paratroopers were killed. Speaking after the siege ended, Nicolas Sarkozy, the French president, expressed his condolences for the families of the seven victims killed by the suspect and pledged to crack down on ideologies that involved extremist indoctrination. Quote, "Henceforth, any person who habitually consults internet sites which praise terrorism and which call for hatred and violence will be punished under criminal law," end quote, he said in a televised address.
And those are your international headlines. Now we go to Free Speech Radio News for their international news.
Iran. For the first time today, President Obama addressed the killing of Trayvon Martin, the unarmed African-American teen shot by a neighborhood watch guard in Florida.
"And when I think about this boy, I think about my own kids. And you know, I think every parent in America should be able to understand why it is absolutely imperative that we investigate every aspect of this."
He then went on to say the teenager's parents have a right to expect the case would be treated with the seriousness it deserves.
"You know, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon."
Students at several high schools in Miami staged walkouts this morning, demanding justice for the teen. Yesterday, Florida Governor Rick Scott named a special prosecutor to the case, according to state media. He also ordered a review of the state's so-called Stand Your Ground law, under which police allowed shooter George Zimmerman to walk free. At the same announcement today, President Obama named his nominee to be the next head of the World Bank.
"The leader of the World Bank should have a deep understanding of both the role that development plays in the world and the importance of creating conditions where assistance is no longer needed. I believe that nobody is more qualified to carry out that mission than Dr. Jim Kim. It's time for a development professional to lead the world's largest development agency."
Dr. Kim, who was born in Korea, is the current president of Dartmouth, co-founded Partners in Health, and led a UN push to treat 3 million people with HIV/AIDS. Because of World Bank voting structure and tradition, Kim is widely seen as a front runner for the position. Today, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced the U.S. would give $1.3 billion worth of military aid to Egypt. This despite a State Department acknowledgement that the Egyptian government is not meeting, quote, legislative conditions related to Egypt's democratic transition. The U.S. will waive these requirements, citing the larger goal of maintaining a strategic partnership with Egypt. The decision is receiving criticism from some members of Congress who are saying the U.S. is ignoring human rights issues and delays in the democratic process. Peaceful demonstrations in three cities Thursday ended in arrests of more than 140 people as activists protest what they called a rogue nuclear reactor. The Vermont Yankee power plant, of the same design as Fukushima, has received a 20-year license extension from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. However, the state has not renewed the license, and the Public Service Board ruled Monday that the plant's owners would be in violation of state law if they continued operations. FSRN's Carl Ettmeyer has the story from Montpelier.
On a sunny Thursday morning, about 1,000 colorfully clad demonstrators converged on the Brattleboro Common and marched 3.5 miles to Vermont Yankee corporate headquarters. There, some of them walked to the office building's driveway, ducked under a yellow rope, and continued forward. Brattleboro police, through a bullhorn, told the protesters they were trespassing.
Your conduct is a violation of Vermont Statute Title 13, Section 3705, unlawful trespass.
Audio provided by Eric Bachman. 130 demonstrators were arrested at the headquarters. Elsewhere, members of a group calling itself the Vermont Natural Guard showed up unannounced at the offices of reactor owner Entergy in White Plains, New York, and New Orleans. There, they demanded the plant be closed immediately. Eric Gillard joined protesters in White Plains.
They've defied and attacked Vermont's democratic process and our sovereignty to regulate industry in the state.
Police arrested 5 people in White Plains, including Gillard, and 7 in New Orleans. Carl Ettmeyer, FSRN, in Montpelier, Vermont.
With much of the social and political rhetoric of the U.S. mired in Christian and other religious doctrines, secular organizers are promoting visibility of an often overlooked yet significant segment of the population. This Saturday, during the Reason Rally, the National Mall will host what is being billed as the largest gathering of atheists in history. FSRN's Brad Kuttner has the story.
An estimated 50,000 atheists, humanists, and free-thinking individuals plan to show themselves to the world in Washington, D.C. this weekend. Reason Rally organizers from a coalition of secular groups from around the country said they don't have a political agenda, but just want to be recognized. Billed as a coming-out event, Fred Edwards, National Director of the United Coalition of Reason, said atheists are often persecuted for their beliefs, and this event hopes to change that.
So an awful lot of people are in the closet. It isn't that they're going to suffer dangerous physical persecution or anything like that. But there are all sorts of subtle ways that religion has a powerful influence on one's social standing. And one can pay a social price for coming out. And we want to make it to where that's no longer the case, to where we are just as accepted as everyone else.
A Pew survey in 2007 found 5% of Americans said they did not believe in a higher power. That's more than identified as Mormon, Jewish, Muslim, and Buddhist combined. Brad Kuttner, FSRN, Richmond.
And that's headlines for in FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Continue following yesterday's military coup that deposed President Amadou Toumani Touré. FSRN's Amadou Timbini is in Mali's capital, Bamako. Amadou, thanks for joining us. Bamako's airport is closed and people have been told by the coup leaders not to go to work. What's the situation like on the streets?
As I'm speaking to you right now, the city of Bamako is calm after reports of vandalization and looting of shops last night by gunmen. Government departments remain closed, but banks and shops are reopened today. But some people told me that they are afraid of traveling to downtown Bamako because of the presence of heavily armed soldiers, and they are surrounding the former president's office and the state television.
We're also getting reports that there are shortages of bread and petrol. Can you give us any more information on that?
I saw many people lining up at gas station, fearing that there will be shortage of fuel in the coming days because all land borders are closed, and including airports.
And what is the view of people on the ground towards this coup, and how much support is there for it?
Many people said that they are supportive of coup makers because they accuse the government of mismanagement. And the president, they said that the president was not doing enough to contain the Tuareg rebellion in the north of the country.
FSRN's Amadou Timbeni in Mali's capital, Bamako. The UN Security Council, the United States, and the West African regional body, ECOWAS, condemned the coup. France, the former colonial power, and the EU have cut off aid. Meanwhile, Tuareg rebels continue to advance in the north of Mali. For more, we go to Robin Edward Poulton, Mali expert at Virginia Commonwealth University's School of World Studies. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you for inviting me.
Can you just give us a sense of the political context for this coup?
Well, there are two contexts, really, and one is the north of Mali. In the north, there's two completely new influences, and the first is the availability of big money through the cocaine trade. The cocaine trade has been moving through West Africa and the Sahel, and the Sahara Desert, and through Algeria and Libya into Europe. And the smugglers are very much connected to Al-Qaeda and what is known as Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. And these are really Algerian fundamentalist Islamic former Afghan fighters who are running the drugs trade. And there are other people involved, of course, including Tuaregs and Moors and other people. But that's a lot of big money in the north of Mali. And then there is the destruction of Libya and the southern brigade of the Libyan army, which was largely composed of Mali and Tuaregs. Some of them were born in Libya. Many of them were just mercenaries. And they've come home with huge amounts of weaponry. So we have in the north of Mali, in the Sahara, we have now a Libyan army with massive weapons. And we have large amounts of drug money. And this then brings us to Bamako, where the Malian army is now in a very bad morale. There was a massacre in a village called Agel Hoc, a really brutal massacre of Malian army prisoners of all colors, Arabs and Tuaregs and Bambaras and Soninkes and Sonrais and all the people who were in the army. But the pictures went around the around Bamako of these guys with bullets in their heads and their hands tied behind their back. And that made the army very, very angry. And what you have now is not really a coup d'etat. It's really a mutiny against the higher command by the soldiers, the sergeants, the corporals, and then a couple of lieutenants and one captain called Sanogo, who has apparently taken the title of head of the junta. But I don't really think it's a political movement. I think it was a mutiny.
Now, you're involved in peacekeeping and development work in Mali, and you have a property in Mali that was ransacked last night, but you were also there last month as part of a United Nations peacekeeping mission. What was the government telling you then about how likely it was that this coup, or mutiny as you call it, was on the way?
Well, nobody was talking about coups, but coups were very evidently in the offing. Or the risk of that, because the morale of the army was so bad. We met with various ambassadors, we met all the ministers involved, and we met, of course, the president and lots of councillors in the presidency. While we were there, the women in the Kati barracks revolted because their brothers and husbands and sons had just been victims of this defeat in Agel Hoc. And the government has been extremely weak in communications. And we've discussed that with many people. The problem is that if you have a president who's a general, a former general, and if you have several of his key ministers who are generals, then they are not politically skilled communicators. They are militarily skilled organizers, and this is a communications failure. They didn't give out the information about the massacre in Agel Hoc. The women marched on the palace. They got to the palace gates, they were rattling the gates. And so the president spent 2 hours with the women explaining himself and explaining the situation. And he, I must say, he explained it all very well, but it shouldn't have to be the president who explains these things. We weren't quite at the area of the mutiny, but we were not far away from it. And as we see now, the mutiny has just taken place.
And yet elections were scheduled to take place at the end of April. Why did these members of the military carry out this coup now and not just wait a few weeks and perhaps change the government democratically?
I don't think that the junta has any plans. I don't think they planned this, really. I think it's just complete chaos. They're going around looting bars and shooting in the air. There's no discipline. It's not impossible. The elections on the 29th of April could still take place. It's not probable, but it is still possible.
Robin Edward Poulton, Mali expert at Virginia Commonwealth University, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
The U.S. Attorney General has signed new rules into law that allow the National Counterterrorism Center to mine other agencies for data on anyone in the U.S. and hold data for up to 5 years. The Justice Department says this will help the government connect the dots and prevent acts of terrorism. But privacy advocates are concerned and say the new measures give the government too much power and too little accountability. FSRN's Alice Olstein has the story in Washington, D.C.
Surveillance of U.S. citizens and residents will be expanded under new guidelines approved by Attorney General Eric Holder. Intelligence officials will now be able to store private data on Americans for up to 5 years, even if there is no evidence linking an individual to terrorism. The National Counterterrorism Center will also be able to copy entire databases from other government agencies and comb through them looking for patterns. Officials say this kind of data sharing is crucial for stopping both physical and cyber attacks. But Mark Rotenberg from the Electronic Privacy Information Center says the government has gone too far.
We oppose this. It violates the Federal Privacy Act. It places at risk people whose personal information will now be accessible across the federal government.
The National Security Agency was given similar powers under the Bush administration's Total Information Awareness Initiative, which Congress defunded in 2003, citing concerns about mass surveillance. Rotenberg says these new measures are a reincarnation of that controversial program.
It's being reborn in pieces as federal agencies look for ways to combine more and more information. And the big threat here is the lack of oversight and the lack of accountability.
Though the new guidelines specifically say people won't be monitored for exercising their First Amendment rights, there is evidence this is already happening. Responding to Freedom of Information Act requests, the Department of Homeland Security released several hundred documents this week, some of which show how different federal agencies have been gathering information on the Occupy movement. Mara Verheyden-Hilliard is with the Partnership for Civil Justice, one of the groups that demanded the documents.
We did this in the wake of the obviously coordinated crackdown on Occupy demonstrations around the country. And what's very significant about these materials is that they show at the highest levels of the Department of Homeland Security an intense focus on the Occupy movement and also sort of their public visible response to the Occupy movement.
Many of the published documents had large sections redacted, and civil liberties groups will demand more be released. But Verheyden-Hilliard says one memo outlined how to gather intelligence on activists, focusing on a tactic called the congruence concept.
It's the idea that if you can link First Amendment activity with any threat or claim, you know, no matter how baseless, unsupported, unsourced, anonymous, that there's going to be some criminal activity, then that justifies intelligence gathering into that.
Verheyden-Hilliard says the new government powers announced Thursday could formalize this kind of surveillance.
This is something that U.S. intelligence services and law enforcement have always done against the social justice movement. But we saw it really ramped up under Bush. And when Obama came in, he has made not the slightest effort to restrict the mass intelligence gathering on people in the United States who have committed no wrongdoing and are not suspected of committing any wrongdoing. And in fact, we believe it's gotten worse, it's gotten more intense, and as you can see, it's basically getting codified.
The federal government could gain even more access to personal data if the Senate passes one of the cybersecurity bills currently under consideration. Rotenberg from EPIC says not enough people are aware of how much information corporations could soon turn over to the federal government.
If you're concerned about protecting privacy, it isn't just about limiting data collection on the government side. You also need to think about how to limit data collection in the private sector because the government has the ability to get access to that data.
Independent Joe Lieberman's bill allows the Department of Homeland Security to enforce cybersecurity measures at private companies, while Republican John McCain's legislation increases information sharing. McCain's bill would allow the government to search data from medical organizations, banks, telephone companies, and internet browsers, and gives the companies immunity from any lawsuit related to the data sharing. both bills could come up for a vote in the Senate in the next few weeks. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
We're going to switch gears here for a couple of minutes just to go over something that has been very popular, especially among young people in the past couple of weeks, and that is Kony 2012. Originally, we are very against, as CJ would say, doing mainstream news, but you can't really ignore Kony 2012. It's been huge. As I told CJ earlier, don't hate the player, hate the game. We're going to have to talk about it because it's kind of everywhere these days. So I think everybody knows, well, if anybody doesn't know what Kony 2012 has been, it was just a massive campaign to basically, it started by Invisible Children, which is a non-profit organization, and they made a video about Joseph Kony, a man who is part of an organization which kidnaps children in Uganda and makes them into child soldiers, or other worse things, makes them part of the sex trade industry.
And also a man who has been charged by the International Criminal Code. The first man to be charged.
Yes. So this video was against him and trying to make money for him, and it seemed like an awesome cause. But when people were looking into the video, there was a lot of hype coming in about... Once you looked at the video a lot, it became known that it was not necessarily doing good things. Some of that money, there was transparency issues with the organization Invisible Children. And now Uganda has launched a video to counter Kony 2012. So Amama Mbabazi, the Ugandan Prime Minister, launched an online response to the video, calling for the arrest of Joseph Kony, who was the leader of the LRA, which is the Lord's Resistance Army. So in response, it seems to correct the false impression that Uganda is in conflict. In the 8-minute video and in a flurry of messages posted on the microblogging site Twitter, Mbazi invited 20 celebrities, including Angelina Jolie, George Clooney, Justin Bieber, Lady Gaga, and Rihanna. As Prime Minister, he said, quote, "As Prime Minister of Uganda, I appreciate your interest and invite you to visit. We have peace, stability, and great people," he wrote on the Twitter message to celebrities using the hashtag Kony is in Uganda, isn't in Uganda. The video Kony 2012 by Invisible Children is an advocacy group. They're based in San Diego. Their video has been viewed now by over 80 million people worldwide. He also says that it is particularly welcome to see so many young people uniting across barriers of the nation, race, religion, and culture to take a stand for justice. "I salute you and I thank you," end quote, Mbazi said in the video. He also said that he extends the invitation not just to the 20 celebrities, but to everyone. He said, come to see Uganda for yourself, and you'll find a very different place to that portrayed by Invisible Children. In the video, Mbazi is speaking to the camera in a simple broadcast film at his office desk, and he wanted to correct the, quote, well-intentioned, end quote, video, and pointed out that Joseph Kony actually isn't in Uganda and that the country isn't in conflict. So, yeah, Kony's rebel army has been accused of mutilating civilians and abducting children to use as soldiers and sex slaves during its two-war decade in northern Uganda. But now it is known that apparently the Lord's Resistance Army, the LRA, actually isn't even in Uganda. It's moving in other areas of Africa. And that was the whole point of the kind of backlash to Kony 2012. So we are going to take a break and then go back to our broadcasts from FSRN, which is Free Speech Radio News.
The 26th annual Brave New Playwrights Festival is almost here. Get stoked for comedies, tragedies, musicals, fairy tales,
and dramas.
To be or not to be.
This year's festival includes over 30 actors, 12 plays, 12 directors, over a dozen designers, one stage reading, nearly 20 crew members, and 26 years of history under its belt. If that was too much math for you, just go to bravenew.ca for info and tickets. Brave New Playwrights, March 28th to April 1st.
You cannot spell Discorder without disco. And to disco is to attend or dance at such a club or party. Attend the Discorder fundraiser March 29th at the Biltmore Cabaret. There will be bands, swag, a silent auction, and more. Disco with Discorder, March 29th at the Biltmore, and keep that magazine from CITR Radio in print.
This April, Chamber Concerts and CITR Radio are proud to present
Mike Doughty, April 5th at the Media Club. Doors are at 8 and the show begins at 9 p.m. The American singer-songwriter, formerly of Soul Coughing, is on tour performing a concert and conducting Q&As about his new book, The Book of Drugs.
Chairlift with special guest Night Jewel, Friday, April 6th at the Electric Owl. This will be an early show, ending at 11. All the way from Brooklyn, this electro-pop duo is on tour to support that new release, Something.
First Aid Kit with special guest Peggy Sue, Thursday, April 10th at Venue. Coming at you from Sweden, First Aid Kit is an indie folk duo touring to support their latest release, The Lion's Roar. For tickets, visit northerntickets.com or Red Cat High Life and Zulu Records. For more information, please visit chamberconcerts.com.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
We are going to go back to FSRN and their headlines.
For 6 weeks, students in the Canadian province of Quebec have been on strike in opposition to the provincial government's plan to increase tuition fees by 75%. Yesterday, more than 300,000 college and university students went on strike, and many of them rallied in the streets. FSRN's Lillian Bochter has more.
In what's being called the largest mass mobilization in Quebec's history, hundreds of thousands abandoned classes and took to the streets in Montreal. Students opposed Premier Jean Charest's government plan to raise student fees by more than $1,600 to about $3,800 a year over the next 5 years. For the last month and a half, Quebec post-secondary students have been progressively joining an unlimited general strike. Thursday was the culmination of weeks of actions and protests throughout the province on an almost daily basis, with students blocking bridges, downtown centers, and occupying government and university administration buildings. Police response has been increasingly harsh. Officers have used tear gas, rubber bullets, and flashbang grenades, with one student nearly losing his eye after police attacked protesters. A few hundred students started the day by blocking the Montreal port. As truckers honked their horns in support of the students, college student Felix Soto highlighted that this struggle went beyond just students.
It's a societal debate, and access to education should stay free and accessible for all.
Determined students filled 50 city blocks with a sea of red, the color of their Stop the Fee Hikes campaign. Dancing, singing, and chanting for hours in the exceptionally warm March day, the carnival atmosphere lasted into the evening with free shows by Quebec musicians supporting the strikers. International students and elementary and high school students also took to the streets, along with families and their babies, concerned about the fee hikes on future generations. Salome Nathalie is an 18-year-old student of human sciences at Bois Boulogne College. She's one of the increasing numbers of students that balance work and school. She says she's worried about how the tuition increases will affect her studies.
I'm here because I'm not going to be able to pay for university. I'm going to have to work part-time jobs. My friends are not going to be able to pay, and I'm there for them too.
Some students are calling for free education, including Marcus Lake, who studies electroacoustics at Concordia University. He says he's also concerned about the way colleges and universities manage their money.
There is a gross mismanagement of funds within the university.
and that's why I'm on strike. And today, more than anything, I'm just excited about people feeling like they can make a change.
Recently, Concordia was fined $2 million by Quebec's education ministry for spending too much money on severance packages for top administrators. Students are also concerned that tuition hikes will increase the gap between the rich and the poor. Amy Darwish is finishing a master's degree in social work at McGill University. She says that the tuition hikes should not be viewed in isolation, but rather in the broader set of austerity policies that the Charest government is imposing on Quebec society.
The Charest government over the last few years has introduced budgets that have been seeking to, you know, impose user fees on healthcare and other public services, as well as to raise tuition, while at the same time not making any kind of reductions in terms of corporate tax cuts and so on. I think it really speaks to their priorities, and I think it's really quite worrisome that this agenda will be carried out on the backs of those who are least able to afford it.
Meanwhile, the Minister of Education, the Finance Minister, and Premier Jean Charest say that the hikes are necessary because Quebec schools are underfunded, but residents of the province pay the highest taxes in Canada. Nadeau Dubois says the next steps will be to impose economic pressure on the Charest government. Student actions are taking place in Montreal Friday, targeting Education Minister Lynn Beauchamp. Lillian Bachter, FSRN, Montreal.
Last year, FSRN reported on the use of the toxic fumigant methyl iodide in Florida. On strawberry and tomato fields, and how Florida's Department of Agriculture did not keep track of where the pesticide was used. Today, FSRN's Kelly Benjamin reports that after months of harsh criticism and a lawsuit on behalf of farmers, health workers and environmental activists, the makers of methyl iodide have suspended all US sales.
The manufacturer of methyl iodide, Arista Life Science, says they're pulling the pesticide from the market in the US based on its economic viability. Environmental and farm worker advocacy groups applaud the announcement. They've claimed the pesticide is far too dangerous for use in agriculture. Jeannie Economos is the Health and Safety Coordinator for the Farm Worker Association of Florida.
This is a great testament to collaborative efforts all around the country, because different organizations, farm worker, pesticide, environmental organizations around the country, were unified in our opposition to this, including some major scientists in California and other places that opposed this. And I think it just shows that there is power to the people when people stand together and work together for a cause, for a joint cause.
The decision to pull methyl iodide from the market comes in the wake of a lawsuit brought by environmental groups in California aimed at overturning the approval of the pesticide in the state. Greg Laurie is an attorney with Earth Justice, a law firm that represents a coalition of farm worker and environmental organizations.
Methyl iodide is an extremely toxic chemical known to cause cancer, birth defects, it pollutes the groundwater, and it's a chemical that we really don't need. There are alternatives to methyl iodide that already are out there, and there was no need to bring a new, incredibly toxic pesticide onto the market. Well, the decision by Arista to suspend sales and to actually cancel the registration in California, at least, is a tremendous victory. Really exceeds our wildest dreams as to the outcome of this case.
While Laurie says methyl iodide was only used 6 times in California, its use in Florida was much more widespread. But few know where it was used, as Florida's Department of Agriculture did not track its use as they did in California.
It was used in greater quantities in Florida. My understanding is that it was sprayed on about 17,000 acres, which is a tiny, tiny fraction, of course, of U.S. cropland. And while we don't have evidence of any immediate harm from any of those fumigations, the insidious thing about methyl iodide is that it causes cancer and that it pollutes the groundwater. So these are impacts that don't manifest immediately, but rather, they take time, and you never really know until years have gone by.
FSRN contacted a representative of Arista Life Science who refused to speak on record about methyl iodide. Arista's press release says they'll continue to market methyl iodide outside the U.S. Kelly Benjamin, FSRN, Tampa, Florida.
And Obama gave his blessing to the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline today, which would stretch from Oklahoma to Gulf Coast refineries. But indigenous and environmental groups are protesting, saying the project threatens the air and water, as well as native burial sites. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Standing in front of a huge stack of pipe segments in Cushing, Oklahoma, the president explained how his administration was moving forward on TransCanada's application to start building the southern half of the Keystone XL pipeline.
Today I'm directing my administration to cut through the red tape, break through the bureaucratic hurdles, and make this project a priority, to go ahead and get it done.
When TransCanada first applied to build the more than 1,100-mile project, the president moved to delay the decision until 2013, citing environmental concerns that needed additional study. When Congress passed a bill forcing him to make a decision on the full pipeline within 60 days, he rejected the permit. But in his speech Thursday, President Obama cited the many oil and gas drilling projects he has approved and will approve in the future.
And as long as I'm president, we're going to keep on encouraging oil development and infrastructure, and we're going to do it in a way that protects the health and safety of the American people. We don't have to choose between one or the other. We can do both.
But the hundreds of protesters who gathered in Cushing to oppose the Keystone construction disagreed. Among them was Rosemary Crawford, a Cherokee and Choctaw Native American who has been working to educate Oklahomans about the Keystone Pipeline for the past 2 years.
Our concern as Native Americans, because this pipeline is coming down through our Indian territory, is that we have burial grounds that are not marked and that we are not being allowed to have the list of where those archaeological sites will be destroyed. We also have concerns about the product that's in the pipe, and we would really like to keep that out of our water supply.
Crawford and the other demonstrators were kept about 6 miles from the site of President Obama's address, but say they'll continue to voice their opposition as the project goes forward. TransCanada has also announced its plans to reapply for the northern leg of the pipeline, which needs the State Department's approval to cross the U.S.-Canada border. The company says it will change the pipeline's Nebraska route to avoid environmentally sensitive areas, one of the major concerns that led to the first application's dismissal. But Jane Klebe from the group Bold Nebraska says this won't solve the pipeline's risks to her state.
TransCanada continues to talk about the reroute map, saying they're just going to, quote-unquote, jog around the sandhills about 20 or 30 miles, and then continue going down with their current route. So if that's the case, it's still going to cut through the heart of the Ogallala Aquifer. And tar sands, which is the contents of the Keystone XL pipeline, is a more dangerous type of oil.
Minutes after the president's speech, the White House published an executive order expediting the review of the southern leg of the Keystone XL, saying the project could, quote, create jobs, promote American energy production, and ultimately benefit consumers. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
And that's our program for March 23rd, 2012. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast, listen to past shows, and listen to our interviews on our website, citr.ca. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Nina Kurigia.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by Morgan Yee. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM.